Well, how many people were here last week? Oh, more than half of you. Okay, great. Well, I should just very briefly let those of you know that weren't here what we talked about, at least the topic last week, because we'll segue kind of into this current topic. Last week we talked about samatha practice or concentration practice. And this week I want to speak about vipassana. And you'll often hear these terms paired, samatha and vipassana. Samatha being concentration or tranquility, the development of the stability of mind. And vipassana is translated as clear seeing, or seeing things as they are actually occurring. Sometimes we think of vipassana as being equated with a technique, like I'm doing vipassana because I'm following the breath. But vipassana actually means clear seeing. It's actually seeing things as they are. So very often these words you hear together, doing samatha and vipassana, because we concentrate the mind, we stabilize the mind, we gather and collect the mind so that it can then be a very useful tool to do vipassana, to experience things as they are, to perceive things very clearly. Last week we spoke about lots of ways of concentrating the mind, lots of approaches to cultivating stability. Did anybody try any of that during the week? Nobody tried any of it? Oh, good. One person tried something. So, what did you have any experience to share or any question, or what did you do? What aspect touched you?
One particular thing that you reminded me of with the exercise, actually, was just reflecting on something that I'd done that was worthwhile.
Yeah.
And also, and so it's kind of to get in touch with that it really just kind of brought up being in touch with a certain amount of compassion as kind of a starting place. Just connecting with that. It's just something
lovely,
that I was aware
lovely,
of
yeah.
over the week.
Yeah, I'm glad you reflected on that, because we gave quite a bit of time last week to the question of how to gladden the mind. And the primary way that the Buddha suggested to gladden the mind was to reflect upon virtue, to think about and to recollect the times when you did something that was good and kind or generous or virtuous, or when somebody else did something that was good, kind, generous, or virtuous. And the very recollection of that lightens the mind. It brings ease. It brings joy. And that joy creates a conducive foundation for the mind to settle and become concentrated. But very often in our busy, hectic lives, we tend to focus on the problem or whatever isn't right. And sometimes we don't let ourselves rest deep enough in those moments that are really very beautiful and very wholesome and very connected with life, connected with community, connected with each other. Even when we did that exercise in the room, I don't know how many of you felt it, but I really felt a lot more joy in the room. I could see a lot more smiles on the faces, a sense of brightness. The very thought of having done something good, or somebody having done something good for us, brings lightness and brings ease. Was there anything else from last week that you explored a little bit this week? Did anybody count their breaths? Well, were you counting your breaths before? Yeah, okay. Did you try any other system for counting your breaths? We probably went over four different breath counts. Okay, well, you found something that worked. Did you notice any of the factors of happiness arising while you were experiencing the sensations of the breath? To let the sensations of the breath be infused with delight or infused with happiness. Because that can be really helpful for enhancing the stability. So how many people here still feel that it would be helpful for them to develop stronger concentration? Ah, virtually everybody, not quite everybody. Why? Why? What's the purpose? Why would you want to dedicate time to developing concentration?
Stability. Mm-hmm. To be able to see, when one sees a wholesome state arising, to be able to identify it and then to leave it and to return to some state of stability.
Okay.
Swayed by this emotion, that emotion, this thought, that thought.
Okay, great. So that the stability of concentration, in a way, is like a safe refuge from the reactivity of mind and the unwholesome states and defilements. Okay, great.
Mine's kind of similar to what you're saying. I would like to be able to get a little more control over this perennial distraction that I fight with all the time.
Okay.
Okay,
great. Now that's important as well, to be able to not be so distracted. Why else? Another reason? Yeah? Good. There's lots of reasons to develop concentration. It's important to know what they are.
To be able to have an internal source of pleasure.
Yes, and that's not to be underestimated. Because unless we know an internal source of pleasure, we tend to go to the mall, or we tend to go outside of ourselves, outside into things that are actually not going to provide us with the lasting pleasure that comes from a steady or a peaceful mind. Yes?
Sort of along the lines of stability that was mentioned, peace and calmness, which again is a pleasurable experience that after the hecticness of day-to-day life, it's nice again to have sort of that refuge where you gain control and your mind calms down and you get at peace and you're focused.
Okay, great. Yes, and to actually have the ability to let go of the distractions so that you can rest. I mean, so many people don't know how to rest. So the anxieties just start to build and the hecticness starts to build. And even though, one left the office, one is still like doing it at night, like going over in bed, all the things that, should, need to be done and don't know how to put something down. Learning to concentrate helps us to set things down so that we can choose and in a way control and make wise choices as to how we're going to direct our perception. Please.
I thought last week, but you're reminding me of it now, is you talked about wanting something because it's pleasurable, and I realized that I was surprised because I had this idea that, greed, hate, and delusion, if you are trying to get to some state of mind, and that's grasping, and that's not what you should be doing. And so I thought concentration would be good, because I always heard concentration is the proximate cause of wisdom. So I thought, well, I want wisdom. But, maybe that's just another... I mean, I definitely want wisdom.
Okay, good.
But, I don't know if you have time to address.
That's exactly what I want to address next, because when the Buddha was asked, all the previous things that were said are 100% important and are benefits of concentration and are very good reasons for cultivating it and for developing it. But the primary reason that the Buddha gave was for the development of wisdom. And I want to read one, two, three sentences from that. This was repeated in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I pulled it out from 8 suttas, but I'm sure it's in other places, I suppose, but I found it 8 times. Develop concentration. A bhikkhu who is concentrated, bhikkhu would be practitioner, who is concentrated understands things as they really are. It's very clear. And what does he understand as it really is? He understands as it really is, and then I'll talk more about that. But first, really, I want to emphasize this. Develop concentration, because one who is concentrated sees things as they really are. So in a way, the inclining the mind towards happiness, to having the resource of peace, of being able to free the minds from distraction, is all so important, because it creates a container and the possibility of seeing things as they really are. Because if we're distracted, we're not going to see things as they really are. We'll barely see what's right in front of us. When we're distracted, we'll run into things, we'll go through a red light, we'll do all kinds of nutty things because we're distracted. We're not present with the truth of things. We're not present where we are. So it's very important to develop that kind of stability. We'll worry about things that are not actually present. Maybe they've even already been resolved, or they're way beyond our control, and yet the mind will still keep rehashing them, because we're not with the present moment. So one of the primary, or one of the essential things that we learn when we learn to set the hindrances aside, set the defilements aside, clear a space for stability, reduce the distractions, abide with ease and joy in the mind to create a very wholesome space, is we create the conditions that are conducive to wisdom, that are conducive to insight. So we're doing all of this work, but that's not the end. That's not the end reason why we're doing it. We're doing it so that we can have the mind that is a tool that is sharp enough, clear enough, precise enough, and present enough, undistracted enough, to be able to give rise to liberating wisdom. I want to read a little bit. This is a paragraph from the Anguttara Nikaya, number, the collection of the threes, number 100. Suppose a goldsmith or his apprentice builds a furnace, lights a fire in its opening, takes the gold with a pair of tongs and puts it into the furnace. From time to time he blows on it. From time to time, he sprinkles water on it. From time to time, he just looks on. If the goldsmith were to blow on the gold continuously, it might be heated too much. If he continuously sprinkled water on it, it would be too cooled. And if he were to only look at it, the gold would not come to perfect refinement. But if, from time to time, the goldsmith attended to each of these three functions, the gold will become pliant, workable, bright, and it can be easily molded. Whatever ornament the goldsmith wishes to make of it, be it a diadem, an earring, a necklace, or a gold chain, the gold can now be used for that purpose. Similarly, there are three items that a monk devoted to the higher training should give attention to from time to time, namely the item of concentration, the item of energetic effort, and of equanimity. If he gives regular attention to each of these items, then his mind will become pliant, workable, lucid, and not unwieldy, and it will be well concentrated for the destruction of the taints. I like this example. It occurs in a sutta on how to develop concentration. Sometimes we develop concentration through a real focused concentration of the mind. And sometimes, from time to time, we need to bring in the enthusiasm and the zeal of energetic effort. And sometimes, from time to time, we back off and we observe with equanimous or detached onlooking. At different times, a different application of energy is used. But all of them develop a collected, gathered mind of samatha, of tranquility. That then makes the mind workable. It makes the mind pliant, workable, lucid, and not unwieldy. It's one of the beautiful similes that describe ways of creating the conditions of mind that then apply that to liberating insight, or in this case it describes what's called the destruction of the taints, which is the uprooting of the defilements that prevent, basically, ending of grasping, ending of clinging, ending of suffering. So it describes how we basically form our minds so that they become useful tools. There's a phrase in the Visuddhimagga which describes a concentrated mind as one that is fit for work. And I loved that phrase, fit for work. And it's based on an understanding of this sutta, which describes the mind being compared to the metal, that the gold, that in order to make it into something, it has to be fit to be, it has to be malleable, it has to be wieldy, it has to be fit to be worked. What is the work that we apply our mind to? I can say liberating wisdom, but what does that actually mean? What's the work that needs to be done? Say you've already done the things that we've already talked about. You have some set period in your practice when you've actually already set a lot of those hindrances aside. There's a clarity of... Or the defilements just are not really strong. The mind isn't suffering very much. So there's some degree of concentration. There's some degree of steadiness. There's some degree of joy in the mind. There's not much distraction. If thoughts arise, they don't really pull the mind very far off. They're more like wispy thoughts that are way in the background. And they don't disturb you very much. So there's a lot of calmness. There's a lot of tranquility. Now, that may not describe your everyday practice all the time, but no doubt there are times for everyone here where you experience a calm and tranquil abiding, a mind that is just, it's okay, you know, it's okay. So what's the work that needs to be done? What?
Seeing things clearly.
Okay, what do you need to see clearly? Because that's correct, yes. We need to see things clearly, and that's exactly what Vipassana is, and that's what the Buddha said. But he always goes on and says, and then, monks, what does one need to see clearly? You know, you answer one question and get another.
Those three characteristics.
Three characteristics, yes. Who knows the three characteristics? Raise your hand. How many people know them? Oh, okay. How many people know one of three characteristics? Okay, what's one that you know of?
Non-self.
Non-self. Okay, who knows a different characteristic?
Impermanence.
Impermanence, okay. Who knows the third of the characteristics? Together we can do it. Unsatisfactoriness, okay. These are called the three characteristics of conditioned existence, or the three marks of conditioned existence. Anicca is the impermanence of things. And if you look at your experience, consider if there's anything that isn't changing. Any sight that hasn't changed? Any sound that hasn't changed? Any contact? Any touch? Any thought? Any emotion? Any mental state? If you go through all the possible things that you can experience in life, just ask yourself if they're changing. Because it will be very difficult. If you find an experience that hasn't changed and that isn't changing, come and tell me about it. Because everything that I look at is changing. It's part of, it's one of the laws, it's one of the facts of life, of conditioned experience, of anything that takes form, is that it changes. Too often we're not aware of this characteristic of things, and so we try to hold on. We think, I had this happy experience, I want it to last. Well, if we want a happy state, any mental state to last, we are not in touch with the truth of impermanence. Because it can't possibly last, right? It's going to change. And it's not going to change because we want it to change. It's going to change because its nature is to change. And it's not going to not change because we don't want it to change. It's simply going to follow its own laws. And one of those laws is that conditioned things change. If we want a pleasant feeling to stay, it will be the same. If we see a gorgeous sight and we want it to last, it will be the same. Every experience is changing. So anytime we try to interrupt that change, we're not seeing things as they are. But when we're seeing impermanence, when we're just seeing the flow of change, a pleasant experience, but there's no expecting it to last. It's just there as long as it's there. Then we're not in any conflict with our experience and our life. And there's no suffering when it ends. There's no grief when it ends, because there was no demand or expectation for it to last anything other than what its natural course is. So that's one example of experiencing the impermanence of things with seeing things as they are, with clarity, with wisdom. The second characteristic is unsatisfactoriness. That's sometimes a more difficult one. The Pali term is dukkha. And sometimes people think, well, you know, okay, maybe unsatisfactory, but there are a lot of things that are quite satisfactory, you know, that are quite nice, that are quite pleasant. But the unsatisfactory quality of things is linked very much to the impermanence of things. It's conditioned things are unsatisfactory. They're unreliable simply because they cannot be a basis for our lasting satisfaction or happiness. There is nothing that's conditioned that we can grab a hold of and say, now I will be happy because I have this. Whatever it is, even if it gives us temporary bliss or delight or happiness, it's going to change. And when it changes, we'll suffer if we were grasping it. So the very movement of grasping something implies that for that moment that we're grasping it, not only are we not seeing that it's going to change, but there's this moment of delusion that we actually think that we could be happy by grasping this. We actually think that getting that could give us lasting happiness. And so that's not seeing the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness of things. Ajahn Chah used to use the example of seeing the cup as already broken. So he had this nice cup, this little teacup. But to experience it as already broken while he's using it knows both its impermanence and that it's unsatisfactory, it's not reliable. The third one, anatta, not self. I won't go into great detail because you can all come to a whole weekend on the subject. It's a much more complex contemplation because it really looks at the emptiness of self-positioning. So often we orient ourselves in the world, our perception in the world, through a self-referencing. And sometimes you can even experience this self as self. We call it sometimes selfing. You can note selfing. You can note the arising of this construction of being someone by perceiving things. And it can be perceiving, I am somebody who just had this great spiritual experience, or I am somebody who concentrated the mind, or I am somebody who had this insight. But very often it's something as simple as, I am seeing that, or I am hearing this, or I am walking down the room. Now, it's not to say that this mind-body process isn't walking down the room, or isn't speaking, or isn't doing whatever it's we're doing. But sometimes we perceive things in a way that really is bolstering this sense of self. And so we look to see, is there really a sense? Is there really a self? What is this self? How is it constructed? What does it rest upon? if there's a sense of self, is there a sense of, is there an inherent existence, an inherent, a core entity in other things? What actually is this self? So we investigate that, and one of the things that we find is that you can look pretty hard. You can look day after day, and it's going to be pretty hard to actually find something that you can call self. Most people just find a process of grasping, a process of delusion that is that is taken to be or appears as a construction of self. But it's very difficult to actually find a self, because the characteristic of conditioned things is that it is empty of self. This investigation into the three characteristics of things is really the primary direction that Vipassana practice goes in. So if you do a retreat, you will no doubt at some point in that retreat be guided directly and intentionally to perceive the changing nature of things. You might even hear an instruction, experience the changing nature of that sensation. Trying to guide the insight or guide the attention to have an insight into impermanence. Or to question grasping and therefore elicit an insight into dukkha or unsatisfactoriness of things. Or to really explore the perceiver, the subject, the one that we take, the meditator, the position from which we orient ourselves in the world. To explore and to give rise to an insight into anatta or not self. So a lot of Vipassana practice is inclined towards perceiving exactly these three marks of existence or these three characteristics. And they are experienced not as ideas, not as concepts. You can hear 500 lectures on anicca, dukkha, and anatta, or the three characteristics of existence, and you won't be working with them at all. They are perceived in a moment of contact, in a moment of hearing. What occurs then is that moment of hearing a sound known as the character with those characteristics. Are they perceived in a moment of contact? In a moment of touching or feeling pain in the body? Is it my knee is burning? Well, there's a question of anatta has not been seen. But if there's just a direct perception of the changing of pulsing vibrations, this and that, then in that experience of pain, moment to moment changing, there can be an insight into anicca. There can be an insight into unsatisfactoriness. And there can also be an insight into emptiness of self, the non-self, just through the pulsing sensations of a pain, if for that moment we don't take it as mine, we don't take it personally. Sometimes thoughts are a little bit more elusive to meditators because they're more subtle and we tend to believe them a little bit more. They're a little bit harder to bring mindfulness directly to. But thoughts work exactly the same. Have you ever been sitting and meditating and wonder who just thought that? Sometimes the thoughts come and we're not identified with them. We almost can wonder who thought it. You know, who came up with that one? Where did it come from? And we can start to see how ungovernable, how uncontrollable the mind is. And that can also be an angle into an insight into anatta or not self. Of course, thoughts are brilliant for seeing impermanence as well, because you're not going to find an object that changes faster. I mean, the mind just moves so fast. Just try and make a thought last for 2 seconds. I don't think the human mind can do it. Thoughts move faster than that. You may have a number of thoughts on the same subject over the course of 2 seconds, but you're not going to have one thought for 2 seconds. So the three characteristics are perceived on contact. So that is a way of moving from a samatha practice. Say we concentrate, collect the mind, count the breaths, or stay steady with the breaths for a while. Then we open our experience to experience the changing nature of things, or to open our experience to perceive things as they are. So in a way, we're then from preferring just, say, the sensations of the breath or just our concentration object, we then open without preference and allow experience to be whatever it is, and we see the nature of that experience, things as they actually are. So that's one of the primary ways that Vipassana is practiced, and that's one of the ways when this sutta develop concentration. A practitioner who is concentrated understands things as they actually are. And what does he understand as it really is? He understands as it really is, and the first one was the impermanence of the senses. So there's a and implied in that is also anicca, dukkha, and anatta, all three. The characteristics of what occurs in the senses. What else? The Buddha gave three answers to that question. What does he understand as it really is? You can come up. Think about it. What does he understand as it really is? Just reflect for a moment on your own practice, because there's many times when you've looked at experience and then asked, what is this? Or the perception, you may have had some insight or some way of seeing things slightly differently and had a sense, this needs to be understood. This is where the Buddha says, this is what needs to be done, what needs to be understood. So what needs to be understood as it really is? Okay, the other two. Did you have anything? The other two are a little bit more technical, but just wanted to see if anybody had a guess. Any guesses?
Well, it's kind of hard because when you're getting the three characteristics, it seems like it can take you anywhere.
It can, but do you want to take one to it? Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Do you have an angle on that one?
Seeing things how they really are, ignorance is the translation of what is at the root of the cyclic existence. And so the grasping to that which is impermanent,
yeah,
et cetera, is that the lighting in the earth.
Yeah. Okay, great, great. No, you got another one. You got another one. See, I knew you guys could come up with what the Buddha said. it's the way I've asked it was a little bit difficult to guess what they were or to know what they were, because the three characteristics are included in the first one, but the emphasis is on the impermanence of the senses. So now you're describing one that is, the emphasis is more on the grasping, the cause of the suffering. And one of the things that needs to be seen as it really is the Four Noble Truths, which is suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way to the end of suffering. So that's kind of pulled out. Now, it's included, of course, in the unsatisfactoriness of things, but it operates slightly different in an insight practice, in a Vipassana practice, because sometimes we instead of right in a moment, say, a feeling of pain, we feel it, the non-graspability of it. We might feel it as a characteristic of dukkha within the conditioned experience. But sometimes we just sense, we can feel the mind craving, we can feel the mind wanting things to be different than they are. And we can sense the very movement of the mind that is creating suffering, we experience grasping and clinging directly. And then we're taking the Four Noble Truths as the perception and as the contemplation. It may have started with a painful sensation, but really what we're perceiving is the very way the mind tries to grasp. Craving leads to suffering. So that can become a contemplation through the Four Noble Truths. And the third one relates more towards that third characteristic, but very, very specifically as the rise and fall of the five aggregates. Now, the five aggregates, again, I won't go into great detail because you can all come to this one. It's such an important topic. But I can't go into it all. That's why it's going to be a weekend. But just to give you a sense of the aggregates as being a way that we take our experience of mind and body and claim it as self. So the aggregates are form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. But there's a way that perception works when it's diluted that takes our perception of things and creates a sense of self through that. And this is a brilliant one to work with out of deep concentration states, because when the mind is really steady, really, 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 really steady, perhaps even absorbed into deep concentration states, and then one opens that state to experience the changing nature of things or to experience things as they actually are, what the mind tends to rest in and to tends to get highlighted, it's almost like a floodlight is just shined on the very first moment of perception. And that will be exactly how we're relating to things. So the very first moment of perception could be a moment of craving or grasping. The very first moment of perception could be, this has to do with me. It could be a creation of self to refer everything to, which is tends to be a habitual formation. We tend to create self and experience things to create self and self to experience things and end up never really experiencing things because we're always distorting it through the creation of self. And it sort of takes a while to clear out that distortion before we have a direct experience of things as they're actually occurring. So when one comes out of deep concentration, one can experience what's called the rise and fall of the five aggregates, which is a way of sustaining a contemplation on the emptiness of self. And it works very nicely out of concentration. And it's more challenging when the concentration is less. So these are the three things that need to be understood as they really are: the impermanence of the senses, the rise and fall of the aggregates, or how self is formed in perception, and the Four Noble Truths, how suffering, the cause, the origin, the cause, and the ending of suffering. Questions, thoughts? I just, like, threw out a whole lot of stuff. How many people, like, felt that about 50% of the last 15 minutes of my rattling on was like new Pali terms and new things? Let me have a sense of how many people that was pretty new to. Okay. Okay. Don't worry if it all sounded like it was another language. It was. Any questions, though? Maybe I can clarify some little bits.
You mentioned the word anatta.
Oh, anatta. It's translated as not self. Not self. Anicca is translated as impermanence, dukkha as unsatisfactoriness, and anatta as not self. And sometimes you'll just say, people hear people say the three characteristics, or anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And it's such a core tenet in Vipassana practice that if you go to any retreat or hang out for very long, you'll get anicca, dukkha, and anatta. You'll hear them a lot. And in fact, I remember one time I was sitting with Ajahn Amaro, and he was talking about one of the ways that you can practice with concentration is, he calls it giving it the old 1, 2, 3.
One, two, three. Okay, that thought, anicca. That thought, dukkha. That thought, anatta. And poof. So you kind of can clear the space for concentration by letting anything go. That's anicca, dukkha, and anatta. When I was at the forest refuge, one of the Burmese monks that came was oriented very much towards practice through what's the text called the Visuddhimagga. And there's Vipassana practice all includes the three characteristics. But his approach kept, we had a very formal style of reporting our experience. There were very specific things that we were supposed to say and to not say. So we would report what was happening based upon these guidelines for describing our practice. And what he wanted to know was what was called the specific and the general characteristics of each of our best sitting, of what we perceived in our best sitting. So the general characteristics are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. He wanted to know whether or not in every interview, he wanted to know whether we were perceiving the impermanence of things, the unsatisfactoriness of things, or the emptiness of things. Because sometimes we'll have the perception will rest on all three of them, and or one after another. And sometimes the mind will be very, very focused on just one. Sometimes we'll see the arising, or we'll hear the arising, the beginning of a perception, like we'll just hear the arising of a sound, or the arising of a thought, or the arising of a sensation in the body. But we won't, the mind just won't stay with it until it passes. We'll, another arising will occur, and another arising, and another arising, and another arising. So we're very mindful, very present, but we're only catching arising. Well, that's fine, but that needs to be, it actually describes tremendously strong mindfulness, so it's a good experience. But it's something that in that system is clearly reported as one of the general characteristics of things. You'd also report in that system whether you were experiencing the changing things, the arising, the persisting and changing, and then the passing. So you're seeing, a sensation arise in the body, experiencing how it changes, and see it dissolving or diminishing, and then another sensation arise, experience how that changes, and then watching it pass. That'd be one way. And another way is sometimes the attention rests just on the passing, which tends to lead to an insight into the ungraspability of things or the suffering of things, the dukkha of things. Because sometimes it'll just be, instead of the arising, it'll be, this thought is gone, that sensation is gone, that sound is gone, this is gone, this is gone, this is gone. And the mind is just perceiving through the rapid mindfulness, moment to moment, passing, 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 passing. And in Vipassana practice, all of those are fantastic practice. One is not better than the other. And we don't need to, have all of them. But each will lead and incline the mind towards a particular insight. And that, of course, is Vipassana, because that's seeing things as they are, and the insight arises through that. Dick?
For me, I am like one of the earlier models, I guess the third one back, where I'm seeing things arising. And arising, another arising before the other one is fully realized. Mm-hmm. And I can't stick with one thought or feeling or sensation or anything long enough to see how, if ever, it will go away. But then something else comes along, chases it out.
Yeah, so that very often happens.
Fine,
that's totally fine.
Is that a limitation in the practice?
No, that leads to the insight into impermanence.
Well, that's already pretty clear to me.
Well, it's just, you don't have to.
It puts me in a loop, and I'll never get out of it if something doesn't change. So that doesn't change. That pattern doesn't change.
The thought, I'll never get out of it, misses the insight into impermanence. But the perceiving, because of course you'll get out of it, it'll change.
Yeah, but it changes into another reincarnation of itself.
Yeah.
It's not ever seeing something go. Or seeing how things go away.
Yeah. Sometimes we think that we have to see the same thing vanish. But very often, this is not an uncommon experience, and it's actually quite. It happens when mindfulness is very strong that we see this arising, and then the next thing, it's completely gone simply because something else has taken its place. So the mindfulness moves to another experience, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another. If the attention moves into that object, and then into the next one, and then into the next one, it's very easy to feel off balance, because there's a slight grasping into that experience, and then a slight grasping into the next experience, and then a slight grasping. And what you do is in the meditation is you have a sense of just resting back a little bit. Almost just making the space bigger, because actually things are just arising and passing and arising and passing. And if you're seeing the arising, believe me, they're passing. You don't have to stay around to watch it. You don't have to grasp a hold of it to watch it. Just the next arising and the next arising and the next arising and the next arising. From a sense of spacious mind that just allows the space for the arisings of all things. The infinite arisings of life. It's quite beautiful.
It's like flood.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a flow, a flood.
The passing of a crowd.
Yeah.
That's how it feels to me.
Yeah. And sometimes if the mind sort of goes too far into it, wanting something from them or wanting them to slow down or wanting to see each one longer, then we're kind of mucking with it a little bit, and that will cause tension and suffering. But if you just rest back, there are times really when the mind just catches arisings. And there's just no problem with it. It's just no problem. The interesting thing about perception is very often there isn't a problem with the perception. It's that we're not seeing our perception clearly. So when we concentrate the mind and then open the attention to experience all things as they are, so during a concentration practice, we've secluded the mind, we've separated it, we've focused it on just the sensations of the breath or just particular metta or whatever our object is, when we then open the field to experience things as they are, then that moment when the mind is suddenly flooded with the experience of changing sensations, sounds, thoughts, feelings, sensations, all the stuff that when we were just focused, say, on the breath, we weren't really aware of that much because we were just feeling the breath. But when we come out, we start to see how the mind perceives. And the mind actually really can perceive just fine. What's helpful is to see how we're perceiving and to see if we're distorting that perception with ignorance or with a sense of self-orientation, self-perspective. We just see how we're distorting it. But the perception is fine. The perception, in a way, is clean. It's just the perception of arisings. Or it's the perception of passings. Or it's the perception of change.
To me, it seems like a perception of confusion.
There can be confusion if there's a moving into that object. I just rest back a little bit. Just rest back. Please.
When that occurs to me, I'm aware I'm reacting to the rising and the passing of things, and that's what makes me suffer, is my reaction to it.
Yeah.
And then retreating to concentration practice gives me freedom from that.
Yeah.
I think probably the truth of it is I don't get into concentration practice really very well. Mm-hmm. Because I don't see the rising and passing away. I see a flood and more flood.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I'm curious, though. You said retreating into concentration practice gets you away from that. Why would you choose to retreat into concentration practice?
To get freedom from... I find myself reacting to the activity in my mind.
Right.
And that tends to... It just snowballs into entanglement in the noise of my mind. And so I can't get any distance from it.
Okay.
So I retreat from that by using concentration practice.
Okay. Do you experience the concentration practice as a freedom from that or a distance from that? From the entanglements?
A freedom sounds good.
Okay. Can you describe how there's a freedom from that?
My mind calms down.
Okay.
Or at least I'm not entangled by it.
Okay.
So in that sense, there's some, it sort of feels like a distance because I'm not all.
Does the entanglement re-arise?
Can't, depending on what where my mind's at.
I mean, okay.
If it's particularly busy or it has a certain amount of energy, sometimes I'll get involved in a hitting.
Yeah. Now, I ask you these questions. Because of one particular interest of mine. One is that I it may just be a semantic thing, but I tend to reserve the term freedom to mean such a clear insight into something that we are no longer seducible by it.
For me, semantically, it's more like...
The distance, or space away from it. A relief from it, yes. Now, see, I would call that more being aloof from. One of the things that's been very important to me in my understanding of combining samatha and vipassana practice, or concentration and insight, is to know when to do which, and to know what the purpose of each is for. So... we clear a space away from the entanglements, the hindrances, the obsessions of mind, all that stuff, in order to sharpen the mind, in order to concentrate it, so that we make the mind malleable and wieldy. Oh, I had another quote I wanted to read that had the great, great words in it. But we then apply that directly to the nature of things. So if you were already concentrated, and then there was you were experiencing, say you did some concentration practice working with the breath, and then there was more of a flow of changing experiences, but during that flow of that vipassana time, the reaction crept in, hindrances crept in, there was some aversion, some not liking. I would say use the strength of the concentration you had there to see those hindrances. Because there's a certain amount of effort that just is to clear the space to concentrate the mind. But we can't go on pushing all those hindrances away our whole life. We sharpen the mind, and then you almost hope to get those hindrances when you come out, because you trust that you've done a little bit, you know, your 15 minutes or your half an hour of concentration or whatever. You almost hope that you get something really good to apply that to. Well, I mean, it's enough to see the changing nature of things. You don't have to have something unpleasant. But you have a chance to apply the concentrated mind directly to those hindrances. So I'd say don't shy away from them. Only if you're really lost in them. Really lost. A little lost? Oh, no problem. Just note them and kind of regroup within. I make a distinction of a concentration section of my sitting and a vipassana section of my sitting. So say it's half and half. The first half hour will be a steadying of the mind, and the second half hour would be a seeing things as they are without preference. And it's possible to go back and forth, to use an anchor whenever you need to get distracted. But ultimately... the hindrances are not going to be weakened by them being pushed aside. They're going to be weakened only by direct contact with wisdom. So I'm always delighted when I get a good hindrance after a concentration practice, because sometimes they don't arise for a while. And then when they do, it's like, okay, I can see this just as it is. It's just aversion. It's like nothing more than that. It's nothing but a thought. And it sort of really deflates. Kind of goes poof. And that's when I would say there's a moment of freedom from the hindrance.
Okay.
rather than just a space. Because if I'm still making effort to hold them away, if I'm still having to like really focus the mind here, then I'm not free from it. I'm just like redirecting my energy. But when the mind sees it and they go poof, then I would say. So be very intentional as to when you're using concentration to sharpen the mind. You know, if you really get lost, it's much better to be to concentrate the mind than to be weaving stories of revenge in your mind or extreme states of self-doubt or self or greed or whatever the states are. So sometimes it is skillful to actually retreat into concentration. But I'd be brave and encounter the changing nature of things in every sitting. Lee Brazington told me that his teacher, Aya Kema, said that the general ratio that she recommended is a third concentration and a two-thirds vipassana. So if you're sitting for an hour, 20 minutes of concentration, so just staying with the breath, and the other 40 minutes would be experiencing the changing flow of sensations and thoughts with mindfulness. I've been liking half and half myself lately. Yeah, it could change next week, but I'm very much committed to using concentration as a basis for insight and not just as a pleasant abiding. We should probably end, though. So why don't we talk after? Go ahead.
The basic process for getting into the concentration mode is what?
There's lots. That's lots of ways, but I think the common one that's taught here and that I feel the closest with is just focusing on the sensations of the breath. Yeah, and just really giving preference to a single object. That's the primary distinction. If you stay with the physicality, or if you stay with the sensations of a single object, you'll get more concentrated than if you open the field to anything.
Yeah, for me, that's the problem, right? Tend to get distracted away into all the other stuff.
Yeah. Well, I see people are going, so let me just say thank you very much, and I hope to see you again. Have a very good evening.